Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
Welcome, everyone, once again to another killer episode of Dead Rock Stars, the only podcast in the world which discusses rock music in as amazing and excruciating detail as this one does, thanks totally to the experience and general handsome good looks of my colleague.
I think you already said all this.
Damn.
Shall we just get on with it?
My dear friend Mick Wall is here, a man who has seen it all, done things with, near, beyond, and to, indeed, people backstage that one should never think about, really. My name is Joel McIver, and between us, Mick and I have written at least 50 books on rock music. We've written several million words in print in your favourite magazines.
I'm struggling here, because I'm having to bow my head to speak into the microphone, but I notice yours is
erect.
Erect.
Yours is flaccid.
Mine is flaccid.
It's not the only thing about
how
it.
How do you, what do you do?
Between us, Mick and I have written at least 50 books.
Oh, fuck me. Are we still doing this? Will you shut up about the 50 fucking books?
Now, between us,
I'm about to become the next dead rock writer if you don't shut up about the 50 books. It's not fucking relevant. Let's talk about Cliff Burton.
Today we'll be talking about a man very close to our hearts, a man who was an integral part of what I believe is probably the biggest heavy metal band ever to exist, or that ever will exist, Mick. I'll be interested in your view on that. We are talking, of course, about Metallica. And we're talking about the late Cliff Burton.
Hurrah, we're there at last.
Bass player for their first three albums, who lost his life in 1986 in tragic circumstances. Now, Mick, you met the great man, I believe.
I did.
What was he like?
Well, over the course of the 50 books you and I have written, my considered opinion is that he was great fun. I mean, obviously, you know, these days you talk about Cliff Burton, what was he like? He wasn't Cliff Burton to me at that time. I was in the studio with them while they were recording Master of Puppets.
Which I'm guessing would have been late 85, early 86?
Yeah, it was in Copenhagen, I think.
Yeah, and Sweet Silence Studios.
And they were playing me the track, Master of Puppets, and Cliff was standing next to me. I hate these moments, you know, I don't get them anymore much.
Yeah.
But in those days where, as the visiting journalist, you'd have to stand in the studio and, this is our new opus, and you'd have to listen to it. And what do? Do you wag your head? Do you do a little dance? Do you make notes? Do you smile? What do you do? I mean, I hated those moments. But, of course, Cliff is standing next to me, and he's absolutely going for it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of amazed and full of awe that you got to see one of the greatest metal albums of all time being recorded. That's a huge thing to me.
But here's my point.
Yeah, yeah.
That wasn't where we were at.
Got it.
At that point.
It was just another album?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember doing the interview with them and saying, why do you do this thing where, like, you start off with a really good riff and it's all rocking and grooving, and then suddenly you just change? And suddenly you're going a different direction, or you bring it all down. I said, is that just to stretch the tracks out to 8 or 9 minutes? Because for me, it's kind of unnecessary.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember them being quite appalled at the suggestion that they were in any way boring. But for me, they were just kids who were doing their best to show how good they were at what they were doing, and how heavy they were, and how big the whole thing was. But you have to remember, at that point, you know, they were still signed to Music for Nations in Britain and Europe, which was a very relatively small independent label. They hadn't had any hits. They hadn't done any videos. They were still very much a band that were underground, a cult. The reason I got sent to cover them at that point by Kerrang was because they had new management in Peter Mench and Cliff Bernstein, who at that point managed Def Leppard, who were about the biggest rock band in the world at that moment, had previously managed AC/DC and all these other people. So the word was, this band are going to be big. They'd also done a deal in America with Elektra, so they finally had a major label behind them. And so I was out there just to kind of almost do them a bit of a favour.
Yeah.
But what I hadn't anticipated was what fun they would be. I mean, Lars dominated the room, as he always does. James Hetfield sort of sulked in a corner. Kirk was just goofy and into his weed and his wine. And Cliff definitely was a man apart, but not in an aloof way.
Yeah.
In a very real and relaxed way. He had a great sense of humour, clearly a very intelligent guy. Mm-hmm. And we all went out for dinner afterwards and drank loads of elephant beer. And what I always found interesting about Cliff, and subsequently as well, when I met him in London and got to talk a little bit, and then after he died, you know, when I was researching my book on Metallica, obviously I'd interviewed all the band about him and other people. And what I loved was the fact that, not just the fact that he wore flares at a time when it was against the law to wear flares, but he plainly had much broader interests than heavy metal. You know, he was a big Kate Bush fan.
R.E.M.
Loved R.E.M., early R.E.M., again before they became better known. He loved the Synchronicity album by The Police.
Yeah.
He quite admired Sting as a bass player.
Oh, yeah, rightly.
He was very into the Peter Gabriel album So. And he gave the others an education. I mean, Lars was a Deep Purple fan. I don't know what James was. You'll tell me. Ted Nugent, Aerosmith?
Aerosmith and Nugent are the two that he always cited. Yeah.
Which were pretty bog-standard, basic,
meat and
boogie,
potatoes,
meat
rock.
And potatoes. Nothing wrong with it, but not educated.
No.
Where Cliff was supremely educated. Mm-hmm. He had a great love of Bach. He'd studied Bach at college. Kirk always used to room with Cliff on the road because both of them were big potheads and the other two weren't. Kirk told me Orion, you know, the instrumental on Master of Puppets, was inspired by Cliff's take on, I think it was Come Sweet Death, the Bach,
it is.
Opie. So for all these reasons, Cliff Burton was more than a metal icon.
Yeah.
He certainly was more than the bass player. He was also, it has to be said, very much an alpha male. So James Hetfield particularly looked up to him and wouldn't cross swords with him. Lars wouldn't either, but Lars came from a very educated, entitled background.
Yeah.
And so he was actually more on a level with Cliff in terms of his own self-esteem and, you know, just feeling very confident about himself. When Cliff died, you know, James inherited that skull ring that Cliff used to wear. But I think if you go back and you look at, for instance, the Cliff 'Em All video, you know, those shots were done by fans in the days before camera phones, bootleg cine video things. And there's a great, I think they're doing For Whom the Bell Tolls somewhere on stage. And I find it very interesting that if you watch James, this is James, you know, who was very insecure and shy, never wanted to be the front man, became the front man by default, really. If you look at it, he seems to spend, in my memory anyway, he spends the whole time looking to his right, where Cliff is. He takes his entire cue from Cliff. If Cliff says it's cool by James. Cliff says it's uncool, that's uncool by James as well.
Amazing.
Dead rock stars lobbing light grenades into the gloom.
For me, Cliff was an incredibly interesting guy. He came from a wonderful family. He was big friends with Jim Martin, who ended up as a guitarist in Faith No More. They were in a high school band together. Jim Martin told me they used to go hunting in the woods with shotguns.
Yeah.
I mean, you wrote a book about Cliff, so I'm going to let you take over at this point. But here's this guy who goes hunting with rifles, has studied Bach, who enjoys this very broad spectrum of music. Did anybody in Slayer ever listen to Kate Bush or talk about Sting, you know? But at the same time, has a very clear sense of who he is. I love those old YouTube videos where that band he was in before Metallica...
Trauma.
This incredibly Spinal Tap-esque heavy metal band, and in their one video they've actually got like a naked virgin on an altar that they're about to sacrifice, and they're all wearing this sort of Judas Priest style armor. And then in the corner of the screen you see this guy in a cardigan and flares playing Tremendous Bass.
It's the best, isn't it?
I don't even think people say, well, he found a home in Metallica. Sort of. I think they found a home in Cliff.
Yeah. One of the most interesting things I think about Cliff is the way he shaped the dynamic within the band, which you've just explained very clearly. That's not usual for the bass player, you know, unless you happen to be Sting, right, who's also at the front of the band, or Lemmy.
Or Phil Lynott.
Indeed. So a lot of this I can attribute to the cleverness of Lars Ulrich, actually. I mean, he spotted Cliff playing in Trauma. You know the sequence of events. The band ended up moving to San Francisco in order to get Cliff into the band, because Cliff didn't want to leave that area. And the reason cited was because LA was full of posers and that they could never make it down there.
Well, that's actually very telling detail, because San Franciscans have always looked down on LA.
Yeah.
You know, as,
it's a class thing. It's such a middle-class place, San Fran.
It's much more European than LA. LA was the bumhole of the universe for most of its existence. You only went there for Hollywood to fail in Hollywood.
Right.
And it wasn't till the 60s and 70s that LA was considered, you know, reasonable. I mean, to this day, you'll get English people going to LA and going, oh, I hate LA. I was in LA and I hated LA. You know, you'll get lots of actors going, well, I was in LA, but after a while, I simply had to come home. I hate LA. You know, I used to live in LA for a while, loved it, loved it. But San Francisco is a different trip, but it's much more European and cultured. Yeah. It's a better place.
Yeah. It's interesting, his family background, you know. At one and the same time, you had a sort of a fairly relaxed homebody, liked to smoke a bit of weed and be at home with his folks. Then again, there was a lot of trauma, no pun intended. You know, his older brother died suddenly, Scott, of, I think, an aneurysm, fairly early in Cliff's life. And that is, according to the legend, you know, and how much do you believe of what is myth and how much is legend and what people tell you, that is what inspired him to take up the bass and play it well in his brother's honour. Now, I don't know if that's true. That's what people say. That's what people told me for the book I did on Cliff. Certainly, he was a prodigy on the bass guitar in a way that most heavy metal bass players are not. And in fact, most bass players generally are not. The precedent really is only really Jaco Pastorius, the jazzer, you know, who became this Jimi Hendrix of
bass. And did he listen to Pastorius?
He did a bit, but he preferred Rush. Geddy Lee was his thing.
Oh.
And that's totally understandable when you think about it, because Geddy was, again, one of the few bass players who were really driving the music forward in an incredibly melodic way.
What about, sorry to interrupt, but what about, actually not sorry to interrupt.
You may interrupt me.
Thank you. Let me just check with the producer. May I interrupt Joel?
He says yes.
He's not even listening. What about people like Larry Graham or Stanley Clarke?
The sort of funk soul thing was not necessarily Cliff's bag. He was into the bands you mentioned earlier, and very much Rush, who's a Rush freak. Oh, and Iron Maiden as well, Steve Harris, Geezer Butler of Sabbath, those two.
I can see Geezer Butler, because I like Geezer Butler. You know, Geezer Butler was very influenced by Jack Bruce.
Yeah.
Steve Harris, though, that kind of machine gun, ding-da-da-ling-da-da-ling-da-da-ling, that was an influence?
It was, and you can see that in the way that Cliff played. Without getting too geeky here, everyone, about bass guitar, you can play with your fingers on the bass, or you can play with a plectrum. Like so many virtuosos, Cliff chose to play with his fingers, and one of the reasons for that was because Steve Harris played incredibly fast and well and accurately with his fingers. In fact, this became this massive deal in Metallica world, right? I remember when they recruited Newsted in 86.
He was a plectrum guy.
He's a plectrum player and a great one, but people always
said, he paid the price, didn't he?
He made a lot of money out of that, you know. I mean, he happened to be with them in that incredibly sort of commercial period.
But he was never truly accepted.
I think that's absolutely true. And the poor guy is still carrying those scars, I think. You know, but then again, how much of this has been inflated by the legend and by the books written by people like you and me over the years? Jason's a tough nut.
I never inflate legends.
No,
I merely throw down the truth, deflate them, as you quite rightly point out.
And the funny thing is that Cliff was not this kind of rock star persona. He wasn't, as far as I know, I never met him because I was only 15 when he died. But from what I understand, he was exactly as you just described him. He was a quiet, sort of relaxed, intellectual kind of chap, right?
I think he would have thoroughly enjoyed being a huge rock star, though.
Yeah, right, yeah.
There were so many different sides to him. The one thing I never particularly picked up on from him was him being particularly against anything.
Yeah.
Other than, as he saw it, posers and fake people, which most of us are against.
might have been a young person's thing. I mean, all this has to be framed within the fact that they were so bloody young. I mean, what did we say and do when we were 22 years old that we no longer would do, you know? And yet that was all Cliff got to do because he died
so
young.
Yeah, well, he was 24 when he died?
Yeah, he was born in 61. In fact, what's weird is that... 62 he was born. Weirdly, I have the same birthday as Cliff, which is kind of...
Same day?
Slightly odd. No, the same date. It's February the 10th. It's not
February
the 10th.
Not the same day. So you're an Aquarius.
That's right, man. I knew you'd come up with that, you hippie.
Aquarius.
Where I was saying earlier was that they decided to move the entire band to North California to be with Cliff, which is amazing, right? And the other thing I want to say is that Trauma were an incredibly mundane band, and I hope they're not listening to this. I interviewed all
I
of
hope
them.
They are. Trauma fans,
you're boring.
Pass this link on to them now, because Joel's about to twist the knife.
What's tragic is that Trauma have just reformed
with
Greg Christian of Testament playing bass, which is a great thing. And I hope
does he wear a cardigan?
I hope they do. Does he have flair? Does he have Lionel Blair's? I hope they do really well.
Does he wear a cardigan? Does he have Lionel Blair's? And will they be sacrificing naked virgins on the altar?
So I think the video you're referring to is an EPK that they had made, where the drummer does a drum solo with flaming drumsticks. Is that the one you've seen?
I obviously don't know it as well as you do.
I'm pretty sure it's
you've
the only
clearly
bit.
Got this on your phone.
Well, I had to. I had to go down the Cliff Burton and Trauma rabbit hole deeply to get that book done. So I spoke to the chaps in Trauma, lovely blokes, all of them. Unfortunately, members of a pretty mundane metal band, I think. Cliff was the star.
The other word would be crap.
Well, no, they weren't crap, though.
No, I think
otherwise,
they were
believe
crap.
Me, I would say. No, they weren't. They were just another every metal band, you know.
Equals crap.
Okay, fine. Yeah. Depending on your point of view.
Yeah. Mine is that they were crap.
Cliff was this star, and he already had the bass solo, Anesthesia Queen
Teeth.
Based on triads. It's a fairly simple thing. And people
triads?
Yeah.
Are they Chinese?
Yeah, exactly.
Mafia.
Yakuza, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
No, three notes put together, you know.
No, I don't know. No, I know nothing about bass.
Oh, well, I know nothing.
I mean, I know Glenn Hughes.
Glenn Hughes? I
have you ever met... Did you?
Great bass player.
Was it called Triad?
Listen to Mickey, so fucking rude. So Cliff joins Metallica, and instantly, as you witnessed yourself, and I'm so envious that you did, he immediately started to sort of, you know, not tell him what to do,
but his
view held sway, didn't it? You know,
He was the John Lennon of the group. He was the Axl Rose. He was the Mick Jagger. He didn't write all the songs, but his influence was all-pervasive, utterly.
Mm. Now, those bass parts, you know, Kirk, who did the foreword to the book I wrote, told me that Cliff overplayed. And any musician will tell you that a lot of virtuosos do that, right?
Right.
Those songs do not need Geddy Lee-style bass parts, right, apart from in the solo sections when they clearly do, and they have those. If you listen to, what is it, the Call of Cthulhu?
Yeah.
The bass parts are exaggerated with a wah pedal, but very, very low in the mix.
We should add, though,
yeah,
that Lars Ulrich's favourite drummer at this point was Neil Peart from Rush.
Yeah.
And if anybody overplayed, especially for someone who couldn't play,
you
know, for Lars, who actually couldn't play drums, he completely overplayed drums while Cliff was overplaying on bass. The difference being Cliff could actually play bass.
The other difference being was that they turned Cliff right down in the mix, whereas they didn't turn Lars down, clearly.
What?
Okay, Killer More has this kind of garage production, so you can hear the bass a bit.
If you listen
to Ride the Lightning and Puppets, you can't really hear the bass that much, apart from in the solo section.
That's a revelation.
Well, no.
I feel diminished. I feel dirtied. They turned Cliff down.
Hang on.
Wankers.
They didn't.
You're thinking of
No,
Jason
I'm not thinking
Houston.
Of Justice. I don't mean they turned him down in that way. I just mean the bass wasn't very high in the mix. That's all. The situation with Injustice for All is that Jason came into the studio. He's playing with a pick instead of fingers. James, it is thought, did not like the way that the picked bass sound sat with the guitars.
Can I just interrupt you there? Yeah. James did not like Jason.
Yeah,
that's kind of what we're saying.
I've heard this from Jason and
they tried to fire him 3 weeks after
he joined. I heard
this,
yeah. In fact, Ross Halfany told me that for the first time.
And Mensch told them, don't be ridiculous.
It wasn't widely known, I think, until you wrote your book and you said that, interestingly. I certainly didn't mention it in mine. Probably should have done.
That's because you were too busy kissy-kissy.
So, readers... I wrote a book about Metallica.
We're back to 50 books, aren't we?
No.
Oh,
I'm not,
Jesus
not going to go
Christ.
Through all of them. Mick wrote a superior book about Metallica, and the reason why it's superior is that he's much braver than I was in mine. I took refuge in talking about the music and the melodies and the fucking harmonies that Cliff brought the rest of.
Yeah, I never listened to any of that stuff.
Whereas Mick was much more courageous when it came to talking about who ran the band, busting the mist that surrounded the band and so on.
Do you know, it wasn't bravery. It's just honestly where my interest... lay.
Yeah.
And I think because, you know, like you say, you were 15 when Cliff died.
Yeah, very much a fan.
Now, if I was doing a book about someone that died when I was 15, it might have been a different situation.
Sure.
The fact is, I was older than Cliff was when he died. Cliff was 24, I was 28.
Yeah.
they to me were like puppies running round, you know. I'd work with Black Sabbath in the 70s. I'd work with Thin Lizzy.
So it's hard to be in awe of people who are younger than you.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I totally get it.
I'd been in the business for nearly 10 years when I met Metallica. Mm-hmm. They'd been in the business for nearly 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And they hadn't sold jack shit yet. So I'm like, OK, show me what you can do. And I reviewed Master of Puppets and I gave it 5 stars and I predicted a big future. So I'm going to give myself that pat on the back, because it could so easily have gone the other way. So they absolutely proved themselves, and it didn't take a genius to see it. We all saw it.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, my field of interest is always much more to do with the people anyway.
Yeah.
And what I found absolutely crucial about Cliff, people always talk about if Cliff hadn't died, they would never have made the Black Album. My point is that Cliff wanted Metallica to be the biggest band in the world.
Yeah.
Here's what they might not have done, is still had Lars in the band.
I love that revelation when that came out, because that led to Scott Ian of Anthrax talking about it. It led to, I don't know, wait, there were reverberations, weren't there? What's interesting to me is that in Metallica, in the Cliff era, you had two absolutely virtuoso musicians, right? And that was James and Cliff. Dave Mustaine had been the other virtuoso previously.
Right.
Kirk is a great guitar player, there's no doubt about that, but he doesn't have the picking hand that Hetfield has. One of the geekier things that people admire about Metallica, if they're musicians, is the strength and precision of James Hetfield's picking hand, which may sound like a minuscule detail, and it kind of is, but it's very much part of the bigger picture of
and
what
everybody's
music
imitated.
Sounded like.
Everybody's imitated. They're still imitating it today.
And, and then Lars, okay, quickly address this thing about Lars. Lars is a perfectly competent drummer, but he's not a virtuoso.
Not even close.
But, you know, he played those drums, man. You know, listen to the drums in Fight Fire with Fire. You know, those are some serious double kick drums. So, well,
I'm trying very hard to keep up.
Yeah. He's a decent
drummer. What are you talking about? Did he kick ass? That's what the kids want to know.
Yeah, of course he did, yeah.
Sort of.
And he and Cliff...
Was he as good as Dave Lombardo?
Nowhere near, and Lars will tell you that himself.
Well, Cliff Burton and James Hetfield were plotting to get rid of Lars and bring in Dave Lombardo.
Now, that would have been a band. And the closest we got to see of it was in 2004 in Download, when Lars had that panic attack on the plane and couldn't come. And he, as he said to me and probably to you, imagine what it's like to have the best fucking drummer in the world playing with your band while you're lying in a hospital in Copenhagen or wherever the fuck it was.
Can you imagine what James Hetfield thinks of having a panic attack?
Yeah. I love your story, by the way, of talking about essential oils in the lift with Kirk, and Hetfield walks in. Tell us quickly.
We're on the road on the Monsters of Rock tour in America in 89. And, you know, Kirk's kind of a hippie, and so am I.
Surfer dude, yeah.
And my girlfriend at the time was very... This is the 80s, you know, we're all vegetarian and new agey and into essential oils.
Yeah.
And me and Kirk are coming down in the lift to the bar to go out and kick ass. And we're talking about essential oils. and literally, I'm explaining to him how lavender was called a medicine chest in a bottle.
Yeah.
Like if you've got a headache, you just rub some on your temples or perhaps your wrist.
And he was well into this.
Oh, we're well into this. But at this point, the lift stops at a certain floor. The door's open and in comes James Hetfield. And I'm like, you know what else is really nice, Kirk, is neroli. Have you tried neroli? Oh, I love the fragrance of neroli. And Kirk's going, I don't know what you're talking about, man. I mean, just shut up. And I'm thinking... No, neroli, you know. And James Hetfield is looking. He's
what
like,
"What the hell, buddy?
What fuck the hell? You, guy.
What the fuck's going on here, man?
Yeah, fuck that shit. That's fag shit.
Limey asshole."
And I'm like, "Oh, okay." And I realised I was being inappropriate.
That's brilliant, though. You know, he wouldn't be like that nowadays.
Who, James?
Yeah, if you, because he's post therapy.
Right.
If you now told him that story, he would probably say, "I'm sorry, I was such a dick." You know, as
he would be putting drops of lavender on his wrist and rubbing them together and. You know, inhaling the fragrance to calm his nerves. See, now, if Lars had got his neroli together while he's having his panic attack, inverted commas, it would have calmed him. And made
well,
it,
possibly.
Or Ylang Ylang. That's another good one. And I tell you who would have been into this is Cliff.
Right.
Because Cliff
was... a total hippie.
Totally into his patchouli, that's for sure.
Patchouli,
incense sticks, very fine weed... from the correct side of the hill, under the proper moon.
Oh, yeah. Did you ever meet Corinne Lynn?
Who?
Cliff's girlfriend.
Oh, no.
Absolutely beautiful woman.
Hippie?
I don't know, but his complete, you know, soulmate for the last year or 18 months of his life.
Wow.
You know? Just a young kid like he was, really.
Right.
I interviewed her. This book spent a long time talking to her. And she is the person that I really got the most information about what Cliff was like as a person from,
wow.
having not had the chance to meet him myself.
Wow.
She told me loads of stuff. One thing that's just popped into my mind is that literally a couple of weeks before he died, he went and bought some tight jeans. And was walking around in them. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No.
Not tight, but, you know, your normal boot cut
No
jeans.
Flares.
No Harry Blairs.
He boot cuts.
See, you're looking at it like this is this major discovery. And it fucking is.
It is a major discovery.
Because we have in our head, don't we, this idea that Cliff wore these massive flares just to piss people off.
Yeah.
But in fact, come 1986, he decided to leave that behind.
Wow.
I love that little nugget of information.
Wow.
Much more than anything else, you know. It's.
I think by then he was passing the flare torch to Prince. Because just after Cliff died, Prince started wearing flares. And I always took that to be Prince's very personal tribute to Cliff Burton. Because let's be fair, in 1986, if you were wearing flares, the only way you could justify that was to be a Cliff Burton fan.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I never would have thought of it that way, Mick.
Yeah. No, I think Prince, in fact, was a very big Metallica fan. I think
Get
you
away.
Can tell. No, definitely on certain tracks that Prince recorded, you can hear the influence of Cliff Burton.
Such as?
Sexy Motherfucker, where the bass is... you don't know your Prince, do you?
No, I know that song very well. I'm just wondering where
about... You know, he's doing triads. With flares on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot... We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Dead rock stars, a little light in the black.
Cliff, to this day, is the rock star that that I think was cheated most cruelly of his potential.
I agree, because most of the rock stars we've discussed in this series died by their own hand in many ways.
Yeah.
I mean, they were victims of their own times or products of their own times.
Yeah.
Nevertheless... They took too many fucking drugs.
But not this guy.
Not this guy. This
you know,
guy actually had barely begun his musical...
Yeah, trajectory.
Yeah.
And you know who the exact parallel is? Randy Rhoads, who died in a pointlessly cruel way at a very young age before he'd even got really started, just a couple of years in. We will talk about it.
Can you imagine if Cliff and Randy...
had played together?
Yeah. Who would be the drummer in that band?
I'm going to say John Bonham. He's the only dead drummer I can think of at the moment. That would have been a lot of notes being played in the room at the same time, though, which leads me back to Kirk's point about Cliff overplaying, which he did. So by the time you've got Master of Puppets, which you were fortunate to be present at...
Clive Burr, fine.
Okay. Then you've got opportunities for Cliff to play bass in three or four different points on that album. The start of Damage Incorporated... The bass solo in the middle of Orion, the one at the end, which most people think is a guitar solo.
Yeah,
it's not,
yeah,
it's a bass solo. It was going to be a guitar solo. Kirk was scheduled to record it, but wasn't able to make the studio that day. And when he did come the next day, fucking Cliff had recorded it on the bass.
Well, he played lead bass, didn't he?
Whenever he could, he did, yeah. And he would definitely have switched off that kind of youthful impulse as the years had passed, because that's what
we
all do. Yeah, when we're young, we all overplay, when we're virtuosos.
When you say we...
I was talking about Ian, our producer's guitar player.
No, when you say we virtuosos are young, continue that.
Let me refocus, if you will. But not what you'd call a competitor by today's shredding standards, interestingly. He would have evolved his technique enormously. He would have ended up like a Geddy Lee, I think, but he would not have been like an Alex Webster of Cannibal Corpse, for example, who does all this ridiculously refined technical stuff which Cliff would not have used. Yeah. So, and Justice for All happened, didn't it, after Cliff's death? I know we're jumping forward a little bit. Mm. Incredibly technical record. To this day, I'm surprised they made it, frankly, without Cliff.
I'm going to interject. My producer said I can.
Okay.
When Cliff dies, the whole question of who's going to replace him.
Oh, God.
Now, I interviewed a lot of people about this, including your guy from...
Armored Saint.
Yes.
Joey Vera.
Yes. And they wanted Joey to come along, and I think they very much would have wanted him to join the band.
Yeah.
But Joey felt Armored Saint had their own career... taking off.
When you think about that now, if Metallica and Armored Saint were viewed as roughly parallel by someone, that blows your mind, doesn't it?
Well, in fact, till Master of Puppets, Armored Saint were considered slightly ahead. They were also managed by Mentioned Bernstein, weren't they?
Okay.
Had a big major deal.
Yeah. I always thought they were so inferior to Metallica.
But at the time, I mean, they'd been on the cover of Kerrang, and it was very much Joey's band. Whereas if he'd been joining Metallica, essentially he'd be joining as the bass
player. Hired hand, yeah. Definitely.
Although he'd have assimilated a lot better than Jason did.
In 86, they did that pivotal tour with Ozzy Osbourne, did they not?
They did, yeah.
And actually, Ozzy and Metallica were both on amazing form, right? Did you see that
I did,
tour?
I did.
Were you in America?
Yes, I was.
Oh, man, what a privilege.
They were only on for about 40 minutes.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
I was there with Ozzy, and checking out the support band wasn't high on my list of priorities. I know this is hard for 15-year-old Joel does not forgive me, but...
What do you mean you didn't go and check out Metallica? Metallica! What, you didn't go and check out Metallica?
Well, I had a little look, you know. I tell you where I did check out Metallica was after they'd finished their set, and Ozzy told me to do this because he was going... Those fucking little shits that keep playing Sabbath, they're fucking taunting me. And he went over to their tiny little bit, and they were all smoking dope and playing Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, at ridiculous volume, and particularly Cliff, who found the whole thing brilliantly amusing, that they should be opening for Ozzy, but they weren't playing any of Ozzy's albums, they were playing... You know, Geezer Butler, bass-led Sabbath.
Talk
and Ozzy
about.
Was getting paranoid, thinking they were taking
paranoid.
A piss. Which they probably were taking the piss.
How could you not? Mm. Talk about a pivotal tour at the right point in your career. Mm. Right? The Americans liked them.
They loved them. Yeah, they loved them. But then Metallica always, it's weird. They had this X factor. They just immediately appealed to the hardcore audience. On that Monsters of Rock tour I mentioned earlier.
With Van Halen headlining, right?
Van Halen headlining, below them the Scorpions.
Metallica, Kingdom Come.
I think there was another one, actually, between Metallica and Dokken.
Dokken.
So Metallica were like the opening act. And yet I remember one day being there and Sammy Hagar, the Van Halen singer, grabbing Lars... And saying, come here. And dragging him away where he could have a sort of quick word with him out of my earshot. And when he came back, I said to Lars, what did he say? And he said, he was telling me, you little fuckers, the Metallica T-shirt is selling as many...
Yes, units or whatever.
Units every day as the official event T-shirt.
I fucking love that.
And in American rock, and I'm sure possibly to this day, although these days it's probably hits on your Facebook. Back then, T-shirt sales were a better indicator of your career than actual record sales.
I heard a funny story about that tour. It's when James goes into the Scorpions' dressing room one morning, about 9 a.m. You must know the story. It says to Rudolf Schenker, hey, you guys got any beer? Rudolf Schenker says, but James, it is only 9 o'clock in the morning.
Was he French?
Hetfield says, I didn't ask the fucking time. I want to know if you got any beer. Oh, that's just brilliant.
Okay, here's my James Hetfield story. When they were doing the Black Album, I was in the studio and it was being produced by Bob Rock. And a bit like the Kirk Hammett with the Neroli, I'm talking to Bob about vegetarianism because by this point I'm a vegetarian. And me and Bob are in the hub, you know, outside the studio, coffee and that. And we're talking about this new place. This is in Los Angeles. We're talking about this new place on Sunset Boulevard called The Source, where it had like hemp tablecloths and, you know, we're talking about... And then James comes in.
Oh, brilliant.
And he comes in, he listens and he goes, McDonald's, fucking golden arches, burgers, red meat. And me and Bob went, yeah. I mean, Bob goes, yeah, well, I sometimes take my kids to McDonald's on a Friday. They do a marvellous kids meal for you.
Chicken alternative. That's great. I love it, really. The juxtaposition of personalities is amazing, isn't it? I wonder if they even ever talk, you know, God.
Dead rock stars. Dead men can't sue.
Cliff's death.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this will know the bare facts.
Well, they might and they might not. I mean, they know they know there was a bus crash.
All right, so they were on the tour. They were on tour with Anthrax through Europe. They played in England just before they crossed over. They played the last show in, Stockholm? On, I believe, the 26th of September, 86. Excuse me if I've got that city wrong. Anyway, they're rolling up this little deserted country highway near a village called Ljungby. And this, as far as I ascertained, and I busted my balls, Mick, this part, trying to speak to as many eyewitnesses as I could to this fucking tragic
me
accident.
Me too, yeah.
As far as I understand it, and tell me if you've studied this and it's different, they're in an English bus. The door was on the right, because it's an English bus. They're driving on the right, obviously, because it's Europe. The right-hand side of the bus, and you know I've talked about this, we've actually tried to sort of work it out, haven't we? The right-hand side of the bus, for some reason, went off the road and went onto the gravel next to the road. Now, if you think about what that does, that means that the front and rear wheel on the right slow down because they're on gravel. So that pulls the bus around slowly. Mm. I don't think they're going too fast.
We don't know that, though.
No, Joel. You're absolutely right. That's supposition on my part.
There was ice on the ground, I know that.
So the bus... well, that's the point of contention. So the bus is gradually turned around until it's facing the way it came, judders to a halt, and then slowly falls onto its side. Now, as the bus falls, the window against which Cliff is sleeping pops out. Cliff falls out, hits the ground, and then the bus hits him. That's the sequence of events as far as I can get it.
I didn't know about the window falling out. I thought he'd gone clean through the window. But you're probably right.
Well, I'll have to check the text between this book I wrote 8 years ago. But for whatever reason, he hit the ground, the bus hit him.
Yeah.
The coroner's report later wrote that he died because of compression of the chest.
Right.
Which is what happens to anybody who gets squashed by anything, right? That's what kills you.
Yeah.
The emergency services came and a crane lifted the bus from Cliff's body. However, it slipped and fell back.
Hit him a second time, yeah.
And it's not known whether he was alive or dead at that point. But it was, you know, feared that he might have been alive and that might have killed him.
Right.
And then the thing about the black ice, which was posited by I know not who, possibly the driver, an English guy who's not been identified as far as I know, was doubted. Hetfield apparently walked up and down the road in his pants, freaked out because he'd seen Cliff's legs sticking out from underneath the bus, couldn't see any ice. No ice was found. You check the weather reports for those days, mate. It doesn't say it's icy.
Well, it was September, wasn't it?
So it's
you
late
think
September,
about it, it's probably
so it's possible. But it's possible.
About. Seems
sounds
more
like
possible
sort of
to me that the kind of thing the driver would say to justify the fact that he'd fucked the whole thing up.
Or he fell asleep or he was pissed.
Yeah.
But he was let go. They kept him for 3 days and let him go. Mm. I spoke to an eyewitness on the scene who was a Swedish photographer who was sent by a local newspaper. I sent him a bunch of questions and he was kind enough to answer them. And he said he didn't see any ice, but he did describe the scene, which was as we've described it. Lars had a broken toe. Bobby, the tour manager, had some injury, as far as I'm concerned. Bobby Schneider. Lars ultimately went off to Copenhagen to be with his family. Gigs were obviously cancelled. Everyone flew home. Cliff's passport was returned, cancelled and returned to his parents. And the news sort of came back to California gradually across the day of the 27th of September, 86. The most horrendous shock to everyone who heard it, you know, I must have spoken to about 50 musicians, both well-known to us and less known from that scene, who all talked about their reactions. It was a fucking horrible bit of research, that, asking people, well, what was it like when you heard your friend was dead? Mm. Awful kind of thing to do, especially with Corinne, his girlfriend, who was just completely knocked out by this. Half of them went and got pissed. Half of them went up to the ranch up in the countryside where you said that they went shooting, you know, and had a big piss up
That's
there.
That's right, yeah.
You know, Ray and Jan had already had a son die, remember, right? Scott had died some years before.
I know, isn't that terrible?
Their second of two sons died, leaving them with their daughter Connie. You know, you're a dad, I'm a dad. How any family gets through that, I have no idea.
No,
they
probably don't.
No, you probably don't. So the loss to us as professionals in the metal scene...
I was on crying at the time.
So you were there on the spot. What happened when the news came on the wire? I shouldn't take the piss, but...
I'll tell you a really odd thing. I wasn't there that day, and I'll tell you why. You know, you said you share a birthday with Cliff.
Yeah.
Well, the day Cliff died was the day my mother died.
Oh, man.
And she died very young at 48. Mm. So I had my own died too young tragedy going on.
So you did.
And so I wasn't actually there the next day in the office.
Yeah.
I remember it very well. It was a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
And the next day I got a phone call about Cliff, and I had to say, I know that's bad, but my mum just died.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about that another time. Quite. This is getting quite gloomy, isn't it?
Well, we are paying respect to these people. I mean, funnily enough, we normally, you and I, don't we take the piss relentlessly out of the subject of our conversation, but there's really very little opportunity to do that with Cliff because he died so young and he was so talented. And as I understand it, he was fundamentally a good bloke.
Yeah, right? I think so.
We can take the piss out of Metallica, the rest of them, relentlessly, and we always will, won't we? Because they've done so many funny things as well as so many great things. Yeah, we know that.
Tell you one memory I do have. After Lars went to Denmark, he came back to London. Peter Mensch, his manager, had a flat in London, and Lars was often a guest there. And there was some show on at the Hammersmith Odeon. I can't remember who it was. This is a week later.
Yeah.
And after the show, I'd been in the, you know, that upstairs bar backstage. Yeah. And I was coming out the side with my girlfriend at the time. And as we happened to come round the front of the Odeon where all the steps are, here was Lars. I'm assuming he'd obviously just come out before me.
Yeah.
Still on crutches. And he's like, ba-dunk, ba-dunk, ba-dunk down the steps. Hey, Mick, hey, Mick. He goes, what did you think of our show? Of course, they'd played there just a short time before.
Yeah.
And my head was still, I think it was the first time I'd gone out.
Of course.
Funnily enough, I think I'd seen Lemmy earlier that night, who was very kind to me. And I didn't know what to say to him. My head was not in that space where I could talk about, because my mum had been very ill before she died. So I don't think I came to the show. You didn't come to the show, man, loser, you know, all this kind of stuff. Mm. So making fun, but at the same time, how could you not come to our show, you know? It was only afterwards, weeks later, it suddenly dawned on me, he didn't even mention Cliff. It didn't even come up. He's on the crutches with the foot in plaster from the accident. That's how fresh it was.
It's mad, isn't it?
And I'm thinking, why didn't he say to me, hey, man, did you hear about Cliff or, you know, or something like that?
Well, you know, they've talked subsequently about how they were unable to process this.
I frankly didn't give a shit.
No, of course.
You know, a lot of it sounds to me like a rock star up his own arse who can only think about his band. And with the speed with which they replace Cliff, who's to say that isn't the case?
See, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? How they did that. I remember being quite shocked by that as a fan.
I mean, all this stuff about, oh, Cliff would have wanted us to carry on. Lars and James wanted us to carry on.
Yeah.
Because there was a tour to be done in Japan. There was a lot of money to be made at that point in Metallica. And if I were them, I would have done exactly the same thing. The same as when we talked about Led Zeppelin. Would they have quit after John Bonham died?
Sure.
Of course not. If it had been the second album or the third album, as it was with Cliff in Metallica, of course they wanted to carry on. But it wasn't because Cliff would have wanted it. What Cliff wanted didn't actually matter
anymore. No. And the power dynamic. Now it was Lars and James's band, right?
Absolutely. And you can see how out of whack that balance became with the Justice album, which for me remains one of their worst albums, although there are some outstanding tracks on there.
It's a bit meandering, isn't it? The production's weird.
I find it very thin.
Well, it is.
There's a couple of great tracks on there, but, you know, that extra dimension they had with Cliff Burton was gone forever.
This thing about replacing Lars, because I only know about this because I read about it in your book, but the idea was that they ultimately didn't do that because replacing two members would have been impossible had they decided to replace Lars after Cliff had died.
Oh, that's not how I read the situation.
Okay.
How I read the situation was that idea died with Cliff because, you know, it's one thing to get rid of Lars and get a better drummer, but you've just lost Cliff.
Yeah, right.
You know, if the Rolling Stones are talking about replacing Charlie Watts, that's a conversation. But if Keith Richards then dies, well,
sure. Yeah.
Actually, do you know what? Let's just get a guitarist in, and especially when you haven't built your empire yet.
Yeah.
I think the thing about Cliff is that he had more to consider than simply megastardom, and he had more options.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, you know, it's hard to imagine Lars going and joining some other band. You know, he wasn't like Matt Sorum or one of these guys who could just slot in as the new drummer in the Scorpions or something.
Yeah,
or Dave Grohl could have easily slotted in with Tom Petty or the Queens of the Stone Age or whoever. So I don't know what would have happened. But one thing I feel sure about is the story would not have been as it proceeded after that.
No. OK, so there's a whole future, isn't there? Post-Cliff. which we will address, no doubt, some other time.
Right, now, right.
So we always, do we not, end these amazing things with by awarding 5 stars for certain criteria to the person under discussion. Now, Cliff, and I know we'll both have a lot to say about this, would you give any marks for star quality? You know.
Well, I would, in the same way that, yeah, you know, maybe, you know, like you might give Patti Smith, you know, a kind of anti-star.
Yeah.
A kind of
Kurt Cobain, maybe?
Yeah, that's a really good analogy.
A kind of
yeah.
dishevelled rock star.
Yeah, a kind of a real rock star because he wasn't trying.
Right. You know? Man, that's deep. Yeah. All right.
So I for charisma, is that what we're saying?
Well, yes, I will allow that, yeah.
Well, I'd give him 5.
5 stars. Influence and legacy. Well, I'll have a crack at that. Bass playing, it's 10 out of 5.
Right.
People cite him regularly. You know, all these years after his death, kids. Yeah. Who were, not only were they not 15 like I was, they weren't even born anywhere near 1986. Right. They'll talk about listening to Cliff's stuff and learning from it.
Yeah.
But in so far as his influence on the band and what they went on to do, what would you say? Forget the bass playing.
His influence on Metallica?
Yeah.
Oh,
he
5.
Pushed them in that direction,
5,
didn't he?
5,
yeah.
5, absolutely.
Okay.
Without Cliff, there was no Metallica until there was no Cliff.
Right, man. His taste for excess, as far as I understand it, that's just a couple of joints every now and then, isn't it?
Oh, I think he liked his acid.
Okay.
I think he would have snorted a few grams of coke.
Here and there.
But I don't think... Excess, that's a different thing.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Excess is a different thing.
Kind of
so I would say,
extrovert, sort of deliberate overdoing it.
Yeah, I'm going to give him 1 for taste for excess.
Amazing, isn't it? Such a normal guy in so many ways.
I think where he was excessive was in his love of music, the bass, Metallica. Joey Vera told me that when Armored Saint supported Metallica,
yeah,
Cliff would come by the dressing room before they went on some nights and go, "I sense weakness in the crowd." So, like, go out and kill, you know. And I think any excessiveness in his nature was utterly funneled into what he did as a musician and as a man.
I have a similar story, actually, which always makes me cry, so I'll try not to. But Frank Bello of Anthrax, himself a fantastic bass player and a friend of Cliff's, told me that when they were on that final tour, after the show every night, Anthrax would have finished their set, Metallica would be about to go on, they would talk bullshit, have some drinks or whatever, and Cliff, before he left, would say to Frank, "Maybe I'll see you later." And Frank would answer, "Maybe you will," right? Or it's the other way around. The other one would say, "Maybe I'll see you later," and the other one would say, "Maybe you will." And it was just like a stupid thing, you know, and they laughed every time they said it. And that's the last memory that Frank has of Cliff. As they played that last show together and they head off into the night, Cliff said, "Maybe I'll see you later." Frank said, "Maybe you will."
Wow.
And that was that.
Yeah.
All right. So the last thing we award a mark out of 5 for is death as a career move, which sounds cynical, but it's not, because a lot of people's profile does rise, does it not, posthumously. Your take on that?
Well, obviously it wasn't a career move for Cliff. In terms of Metallica, in my own book, I make the point that in a very odd way, Cliff's death freed James and Lars to really pursue their goal of ultimate rock stardom, because Cliff was a great leveller, a great qualifier.
Yeah.
He insisted on quality over width.
Right.
You know, it's very clear that Lars and James no longer had that, I was going to say steadying influence. I don't know if it was a steadying influence so much as, you know, Big Brother wasn't around.
Yeah.
And so then they could be as bigger jerks as they wanted to be and get all that out of their system. I'm not saying they're like that today, but back in those days, I mean, Lars talked to me about the months and years after Cliff died as, you know, his lost 48 hours. He talks about 2 years of living in LA where, as he put it, he had a 6-foot dick.
Mm.
You know, this is the days when they're hanging out with Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
I mean, James used to mock Axl, but he loved Slash and hanging out with him.
Right.
I don't know how much of that, with Cliff's much more San Franciscan sense of irony and culture.
Yeah. Arch-humour.
Arch-humour.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Here, but look, one thing we must remember is that people in their millions yearn for those Metallica first 3-album days.
Oh, absolutely.
And they talk about the garage days and they talk about the Cliff era. And the Cliff era is a phrase.
Yeah.
You know, the guy didn't live long and he was only in Metallica for 3 years, man. Maybe 4 years, right? Mm. 3 years. No, 3 years, because it was 83, wasn't it? April 83, John.
Yeah.
In a sense, his greatest legacy is that period of Metallica's career when they executed probably 1, 2, 3 radical turns after that period. Yet that, those three albums are just flawless gold dust for a certain demographic.
Yeah.
And Cliff symbolises that.
Yeah.
That's my view.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Anyway, so how do we get to the next dead rock star?
Both Cliff Burton and our next dead rock star made their mark as part of a four-piece who produced pile-driving music.
Not only that, both bands were famed for favouring street clothes on stage. Lots of denim over fancy stage attire.
Also, both bands clearly featured two band leaders, one a blonde and the other a balding guy.
And Lars Ulrich's a big fan of our next dead rock star's band, having written the introduction to their 40th anniversary book. What's more, Lars also claims that one of the next Dead Rock Stars album covers was the inspiration for Metallica's Black Album. And on that note, everyone, this has been a 7 Digital production. Thank you so much for tuning in. We really appreciate it. Please share and share the heck out of our podcast. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Hell yeah.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.